Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Dr. Philip Otsubomo, assistant professor at the UIW Rosenberg School of Optometry, owner of Alpha Eye Care Associates, and president of the National Optometric Association. Where did you grow up?
Well, it's a half and a half. I grew up in Nigeria till I was about 21. Then I came to the U.S. because I went to Bloomington, Indiana, cold. So I left and it hit to go to a very cold place. So I spent half of my life, spent part of my life in Nigeria and part of it here.
Quite a shock.
Oh, absolutely. It was a shock from coming from where I had never seen snow. Mm-hmm. And I lived in a place where we didn't have a refrigerator. And I say that in the sense that I took a geography class and they talk about snow, they talk about the winter and the summer, but you don't get a good perspective of that until you actually experience it. Until you really get there, you see how brutal the cold is. So I don't think I really acclimatized to that. That's why I moved down to Houston when I finished my optometry degree. I was really ready to migrate with the birds, and I went down.
Well, what was your first really cold day like?
Well, it was rough. I had to go with my roommate. I think we were going to a mall, I don't remember, and we had a car and we were trying to go across the parking lot, and before I knew it, I was on the ground because I fell. And it took me a while to recover because I didn't know how slippery the snow is. I mean, you see this thing and you think, oh, I can just walk on it. And when people were talking about snowshoes, no coats, and at least I could tell that I would need a coat, but certainly not special shoes. So it was terrible. And I remember a day after I was been there for a couple of years, and they had a really brutal winter. I was stuck in my apartment for a day and a half because the porch door, I couldn't open the first door. So I just left there and I said, okay, if it gets bad, I'll call the police and they come dig me out. But I was there in my apartment for a day and a half before I was able to open the door to get out. So, yeah, I experienced some really bad weather.
When did you become interested in optometry?
It's one of those things that basically came to me. When I was in Nigeria, I was working. The government, the federal government, decided that they were going to target certain professions and just to make them available to the people in Nigeria. And one of those was ophthalmic optics. And so they were basically giving people scholarships if you qualify and you were able to get admission somewhere to go do these studies. And so I said, well, this is an opportunity to at least try a different country. So that, me, initially was the push. I was thinking, well, I really want to do architecture. That's what I thought I was going to do. And only because I saw somebody who was making some architectural drawings, and I thought, it was pretty amazing what they did. And in one of my, one of my classes in high school, I don't remember which class it was, we had to do some drawings. So I took a liking to that. So I figured I could go out of the country and do architecture. But the only way I could do that was to pick one of these courses that they were offering the scholarship on. And I picked optometry, ophthalmic optics. Well, turns out I could only do it in a British country, in Britain, but I didn't want to go there. So I had to talk to the people that were sponsoring the scholarship, and they allowed me to come here. So again, I thought, okay, I'm done. I'm here now. Take the first semester of courses, undergraduate, because I didn't even realize you had to do your undergraduate first before you could do optometry. And I did that, and as I was looking into it, so it would have been my first year, I realized that this is not bad at all. This is something that could basically pique my interest. And one day that really, you know, not having a role model, you just don't think about things that are outside of your cycle at all. So even though I figure, okay, this may be good, I still didn't think that it was going to be a good path for me. Till one day I was studying in the library, and this young gentleman came by, an Asian gentleman. He had on a short winter coat, and he just had the personality that I just thought was awesome. I just thought, oh my goodness, this gentleman is young, he's a doctor, he spoke so well, he carried himself so well. That moment just made me feel like, oh my God, this is great. And I could see myself in that same jacket talking to students like me about a profession I enjoy. So that was the really, that was the moment that really told me that this was a good thing to pursue.
Well, you mentioned optics. Most ODs specialize in contact lenses, and you went even further and got a PhD in optics. What is it about optics that excites you?
Well, when I was at Indiana University, I figured that I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Of course, with my scholarship, I was supposed to go back to Nigeria to teach. So I went to expand my horizon so that I will sort of differentiate myself. And one of the areas in optometry that most people differentiate themselves in, if you want to have a higher degree, is something called physiological optics. It's just a general name for higher studies in optometry. So it's not necessarily optics itself, but you know, it's the optics of the eye, some aspect of that. So I decided to do a master's. But of course, after I finished, I went back to Nigeria, didn't get the job. They told me that the agreement was null and void, I could do whatever I wanted. So I decided, okay, fine, I have a master's, why don't I do a PhD? I actually set that in motion before I went to Nigeria. And so I came back and I did that. And because, again, one of the things that I was supposed to be doing when I got back to Nigeria was to teach. And if you have a PhD, it basically puts you, differentiates you as a teacher. And that's why I did that. You mentioned contact lenses. At this point, what I'm doing mostly is research that has to do with contact lenses. For example, when you have a contact lens from company A versus company B in your eye, and they could be the same prescription, and we could test and say, yeah, the prescription in this contact from A and B are the same, but I see better in one than the other. When we check your eyes, we usually check your eyes to say, yes, you are nearsighted, you are farsighted. But the optics of the eye includes a few other parameters that we typically do not check for when we do a routine eye exam. In these days, the equipment is there to actually do those things, to test for those what we call high order aberrations. So my research now is to look at those high order aberrations and see if the reason you may see better in one lens than the other is because this lens, one lens controls higher order aberration better than the other one, or if it's just the way the material is made, if it's the way they actually crafted, made the contact lens, to see what about the lens that makes it easier for you to see. That, in my mind, that's a safety issue, because some people cannot see well at night, even if you give them the best pair of glasses or what you consider to be the best contact lenses. And if you don't see well at night, then you are likely to get yourself into a wreck. So that's why I believe it's important to look at this and to see what is it that makes a lens better for one patient and the other in terms of how they can see. That way, when we say, okay, we're going to put you in this lens, we really have a good reason to put you in that lens.
Change gears here a second. What do you do for downtime?
I look at myself as a community advocate. I'm a little bit into politics. I'm a U.S. citizen, but of course I was not born here. And I see the struggle of different people in the community. And I see how people have told me not to use this word, but I consider myself an immigrant African. I see how people have worked hard to get us the rights that we have now, and what do we need to do to keep those rights? What do we need to have an enabling society for our children? I have two children, and I don't believe they are going to move back to Nigeria. I don't even know that I will move back to Nigeria. So if I'm not going to move back to Nigeria, I'm not going to be excited to tell them you need to go there. So I spend my time really advocating for the community, trying to get people together to say participate in the political process. And that's mostly what I do.
You taught in academia for a number of years, and then you went into private practice. What attracted you from academia to private practice?
Okay, well, when I was in academia, at the time, I sort of looked at it and I said, well, I have a lot of friends out there, and they are doing a lot of things in terms of private practice where they can go out and see a lot of different patients, right? And, of course, there's a financial incentive. Well, they are making money, and they have a lot of time off to do things. So I had some friends that were basically role models for me that said, you can do better if you were out there in the private world. So I can't say that I had such a great reason for wanting to go into private practice, but I went into it, and of course we all know it's tough, but it's also very rewarding. So I was able to do the things that I thought I could do, which is to participate in managed care. That was a time that, for example, Medicaid in Texas was changing from being just a government entity to managed care. I wanted to be involved in all that, and I got a chance to do that. So that was great.
So you went back into academia. What made you, what steered you back?
Okay, so after so many years, one of my passions is really it's advocacy, like I mentioned before. You know, I told you previously that I did not have a mentor who was an optometrist, so indeed I couldn't look up to somebody. But when I was teaching at University of Houston, I believe that I was instrumental in getting quite a few people, especially minority students, into optometry. I believe that I was instrumental in keeping some of them in the profession and ensuring that they graduated and mentoring them through the process. That I definitely missed in private practice. Not that I couldn't really do it. In fact, when I was in private practice, I was still part-time at the University of Houston because I wanted to be engaged with the students. I wanted people to see me just like I saw that Asian doctor in a place to say, wow, hopefully I will exude that type of confidence in myself and be hopefully a good person and a good role model, and that person will say, I want to continue in this path. And a lot of students, also when they have an issue with a faculty member, sometimes they have nowhere, they don't know who to talk to. They don't know who they can go to say, I am really upset and this is the situation and how can I fix it? Sometimes it's a faculty member who can fix those things for you or who can show you the path, who can tell you how it can be fixed. So I missed that opportunity to basically guide students, and that's the main thing that came back into academia. In fact, I came to San Antonio to give a talk to this, where to come for an event that some of the students were having, because I still wanted to get involved. And they asked me if I would consider teaching here. And because I really do want to advocate for students, and I think it's a good thing to do, and that's the main reason I want to come back. And I'm very, very happy that I am back and I can continue to do that work.
What are two things you would advise someone going from academia to private practice there?
Well, I would say if you are going from academia to private practice, make sure you differentiate yourself. Differentiate yourself. You know, this day and age, my goodness, there are optometrists everywhere. And of course, like you know, we are opening new schools. We are up to 22 schools now. Mm-hmm. And more will be on the way. And they are graduating more and more students. So how do you, just putting your name out there and say, Dr. John doesn't make people come, is what are you doing? So I think that people, and I give that advice to myself too, find a niche. Find a niche. It could be contact lenses, and now we have all these scleral lenses. That's a big deal. They're not on the internet yet. I'm also involved in prosthetic eyes. We don't have a whole lot of patients who need prosthetic eyes, but when that patient needs a prosthetic eye, they don't have choices, you know. Mm-hmm. And also plan on delivering exceptional customer service. Fortunately, I would say it's no longer the days when a doctor is a doctor and they know it all, and they, you know, patients go on the internet and challenge you. So, and try and, you know, give patients the absolute best customer service. I think that's where it starts. If you can do that and basically find a niche for yourself, I think you'll be okay.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
What they don't know about me? Just like I mentioned, I'm into politics, and a lot of people don't know that I'm really into politics. I did run for office in Fort Bend County. I'm really an independent, but I call myself a Democrat, and Fort Bend County is a heavy Republican, so yeah. You know. I went. So I ran for county judge in Fort Bend County, and I lost. But it was a good experience. It was a great experience to meet people, to go out there and campaign, and even go to people who will never vote for you and explain to them why you hold a position that you hold. It was wonderful. It was really, really wonderful. Don't think I'll do it again, but certainly that. But a lot of people don't know that I did, that I actually ran for office.
As president of the NOA, yes. How quickly is cultural diversity growing in optometry?
It's not growing fast enough. For a school, you have to weigh a lot of things to say, okay, I want students who can actually graduate. Okay. I want students who will become good optometrists. I want a student who would be able to get a license, and we get that. But there are lots of things that come into play when you are a professional. If you look at it, the fact that you have a 4.0 GPA getting out doesn't mean that you're going to be the best doctor or a good doctor. They don't necessarily go hand in hand. But, you know, suffice to say, everybody wants to get a 4.0. So in terms of cultural diversity, we don't have enough of some groups. I would say, for example, the African American groups to really mimic the population that we live in. Who there are lots of areas where you do not have anybody practicing. It doesn't mean that if you graduate somebody who lives in a low income area that they will necessarily go back to that area, but they are likely to go back to their area, and somebody will see them, just like I saw the Asian doctor, and say, this is what I want to do. So it's certainly not growing fast enough. And if I may say this, the reason that the NOA was formed was because long time ago, the African-American doctors could not become members of the American Optometric Association. I mean, there's a history behind it, because I know people wonder, why do you have this group? Are you trying to segregate yourself? Oh, no, that's not the issue at all. It's just because segregation was handed to us. Somebody said, no, we don't want you. And we said, okay, we're going to go out there and form a group and be, you know, so that our people can also have a chance to have the same type of opportunities that other groups have. And I'm very proud of the NOA, and I think we are doing a lot of work. Like, if we go to any community, we go out there and do community work so that other communities can see us and say, wow, I'm going to be an optometrist. We need a lot more. We need a lot more doctors from the minority groups. Luckily, the Asian group is really growing, and it has grown, and the female group has grown by leaps and bounds. When I went to optometry school, you can count, you know, maybe 4 or 5 students in a class of maybe 80 or 90 that were female. Now it's maybe 60-something% female. So that segment has grown. The Asian population has grown, but the populations that have still not grown, that really need to grow, are the Hispanic population and the African American population. So we haven't done enough to make that happen.
Well, what ways are in place to attract more people of color to the profession?
We are actually trying to work with the optometry school in Berkeley to see if the ASCO, which is the Association of Schools and Colleges of Optometry, might be able to hire somebody to go out there and do recruitment for all of the schools, not just one school. See, if I were, and I'm not, if I were the recruiter for, say, Rosenberg School of Optometry, I mean, do I really know how to reach the minority population? And if you compare to the recruiter for University of Houston, who is better at doing this? So if this project is to find one person who is very well qualified to reach the African-American population, to reach the Hispanic population, and have that person go all over the country trying to recruit good students. Now, like I mentioned, we are not looking for students who cannot compete, because that would really kill the whole system. We are looking for people who can compete. But those students typically go to medical school or dental school because they don't have those good, they have not seen a role model in optometry. Mm-hmm. So we want to be out there. This person will go and basically advocate to qualified students and say, here's a different profession. And where it really hurts too is all the counselors. A lot of the counselors are not really advocates for optometry. So what would they say when a student comes to them and say, I want to be a professional? I say, well, I go to medical school. That's the first thing, and maybe the last thing they tell them, go to medical school. And if they cannot go to medical school, they feel, oh my God, I got cheated. I wasn't able to go to medical school. So now I have to go to optometry school. So we have to elevate the profession ourselves to let people know that this profession is a viable profession, and this profession is something that we can all be proud of. So if we can have this thing that we are working on with Berkeley, if we can actually bring that to fruition, I think that will help a lot in making sure that we attract all the good minority students. Also, at the schools, we need faculty. We need Hispanic faculty. We need African American faculty. When I was at Indiana University, if I had a problem, I went to Dr. Ed Marshall, who has retired now, and I could really go out there and share my frustrations, because I knew that he would advocate for me. I knew he would tell me, oh, Philip, you are totally wrong. Don't ever think about that again. Or, yes, you are right, but this is how you get that done. You have to be able to have this bond with somebody. Now, does that mean I can only have that bond with an African-American, a black faculty, because I'm black? No. But the chances are that it's just so much easier, or at least I will perceive that it's a lot easier to go to this doctor because they are black or they are Hispanic or whatever, and develop that relationship. So I know it's a tough thing, and it's just something that is hard to talk about so quite often, but that's the reality of where we are today.
Including academia, your private practice, and cultural diversity, what's one thing you would change about optometry as it stands now?
Okay. One thing that I think we are really lacking, because I teach practice management here too, apart from to differentiate yourself, is our prescribing authority. Most states have fairly good prescribing authority to say you can prescribe medication to a patient. So a patient comes in with dry eyes. We as optometrists mostly, and I'm not saying everybody, tries to give them samples. So if I want a drug and I don't have a sample of that drug, then I assume that that drug is not the drug to use, then I go with a totally different drug. We are too quick to go to samples. So when the pharmaceutical industry is looking at who is prescribing, they're looking at their prescribing trends, they don't see us measuring up. They see a primary care physician prescribing more eye drops than we do, even though we see a bulk of the patients. So that's where I think we really need to work on. And of course, part of it is we really want to help the patients. We want to make sure the patient doesn't have to spend money to buy these drugs. But if I believe that a drug is the best for that patient, why don't I prescribe it for them instead of handing them samples? And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes rather than hand them one sample, we hand them two samples of different drugs. And when the patient comes back and says, it's getting better, how do we know which one was working or not? So that's where I really think we ought to really concentrate on, to say, we already have this power. I know we are going through, you know, in most states we are looking for more power. We want to be able to do laser, we want to be able to do surgery, we want to be able to do all these things. But the power we have now in most states is to prescribe. And I think we ought to really work hard at prescribing to our patients.
Okay, last question, and we do this to everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
I'm not sure that I know, because I'm basically very conservative, right, in the things I do. So running for office may have been the craziest thing that I've ever done, because it was doomed to failure right away, and I knew that, but I still went through with it. So that would have to be the craziest thing I ever did. That's why running in a section of the community that I knew was not going to be wanting to even listen to what I had to say, but I did it anyways. I actually lost in a primary, right? Uh-huh. And the man that beat me, and this is why, you know, running for office, you never can tell what's going to happen. He did not have a website. He did not have business cards. When they invite us to forums, he will not go. He will not answer questions. He just wasn't participating. Whereas I was out there spending some money, having a website, having these things, and thinking that I was doing everything that you had to do as a politician. But guess what? There was another race that was going on at the same time that was very contentious, where you had an African-American pitch against a Hispanic lady. So that brought a lot of Hispanic voters. And so they went to the poll, and of course, I don't have anything close to a Hispanic name. The other gentleman was Hispanic, so his name was very familiar, and them. So it was a no-brainer. He won. So that was what was humbling to me, that look at this. I actually went out to forums. I actually went to people's homes to knock on doors. I actually tried to go out there. So it's not all about that. Sometimes it's all about things that we cannot control. Whether you have the better message or the worst message, it may not matter, depending on who the electorate is, who is going to be out there to actually vote. So, so he won, and I think mostly because of the fact that he has a Hispanic name. Now, do I blame him? Absolutely not. I mean, hey, maybe I should have worked harder. And, you know, look at what is going on now in our elections, you know. It's hard to tell what people are thinking or what drives people to the polls or away from the polls. So, yeah, just knowing that he didn't even campaign, and I campaigned like crazy, and I lost, was surprising to me.
Well, it's still that you actually got up and ran is
oh, yeah,
a great thing about it. So,
yeah, thank you.
Okay, Philip, it's been great talking with you today. Thanks for chatting with me.